Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about Kathryn Bigelow's new movie, Detroit, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello again.
Hello. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Earlier today, we recorded a Film Stage classic, a Film Stage Show classic review of Eraserhead. That should be out either slightly before this or slightly after it, so keep an eye out for that. Other than that, nothing new to report. Let's go through all the usual housekeeping stuff. You can follow us on Twitter. You can do that at Film Stage Show. Follow us on Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. And of course, you can also email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com, and give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. We love that shit. For anyone who's curious, the reason that we recorded a review of Eraserhead is because last month we had a person give to our Patreon enough money to push us over our threshold just so that we could record a classic movie review. Now, if you would like to receive another classic movie review or a new one every month, all you have to do is give to our Patreon page, go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow, and when we hit certain thresholds, we produce certain new episodes every month. $50 will get us up to classic reviews and onwards from there. So all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow, pledge for as little as $1 an episode, and you will get more of that awesomeness. You'll also get access to our Slack channel where we talk to everyone, and you get entered in to a series of raffles for cool movie shit. So check it out, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. In addition, we're also brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. The reason I call that a streaming cinema is because unlike the Netflixes and Amazons of the world, where it seems to be a veritable dumping ground for anything that they can get their hands on, Mubi actually curates what screens on their app. Every day they introduce a new film, and you have 30 days to watch, so there is a constantly rotating stream of 30 films for your enjoyment. This month, you can catch their early Hitchcock series, getting to see some of Hitchcock's lesser-known early works, such as The Skin Game, Champagne, and Rich and Strange. Which I now feel like I could somehow drop a beat behind and make it sound like it's the verse of a rap song. In addition, we have Creepy from Japanese writer-director Kiyoshi Kurosawa, and that has been described as a combination between Fritz Lang and David Lynch, which if that doesn't get you all kinds of cinematically aroused, I don't know what to do for you. So, check out Mubi. You can get a free 30-day trial. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage. So that's that. We are here today to talk about Detroit. Three white men on the internet talking about Detroit. You know, a little problematic. As problematic as a white director and writer making a movie about the Detroit riots and specifically the incident at the Algiers Motel. Let's find out. So this movie is written by Mark Boal, directed by Kathryn Bigelow, and it stars Anthony Mackie, Algie Smith, John Boyega, and Jacob Lattimore. And, yeah, I'm just going to play the trailer, and then we can get into all of the specifics regarding the movie and our feelings about its creation, and then our feelings about it as a film afterwards. So here you have the trailer.
I assume this is about what went on at the motel.
What happened at the motel?
You don't know, I tell you. I was working security by Wisconsin. And on Tuesday night, we heard gunfire coming from the area near the Algiers. Police was there. There was a lot of shooting. When I went in there, three kids had been killed.
No. So they were killed right before you got there.
All right, so that is the trailer for Detroit. Newest film from Kathryn Bigelow, who previously had done Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. So let's talk about this. First of all, it's based off of a real-life historical event. This is a thing that happened. It took place during the 1967 Detroit riots, and it has to do with a particular incident wherein police and National Guardsmen who were searching for a sniper who had been reported at the Algiers Motel's annex ended up detaining, abusing, and murdering three youths. So, this is obviously quite an incendiary story. It is a horrible, horrible event in U.S. history. And coming as it does in our current world, it's an interesting movie to discuss, especially this past weekend, where a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, resulted in the death of a counter-protester. So,
and numerous injuries as well.
Yeah.
Over the weekend, or I'm sorry, not over the weekend, but over the time
Friday
of the rally,
Saturday,
and then yes,
probably more today. So yeah, It's one of those, I don't want to call it an opportune time because that seems like I'm saying it's good for everyone. But certainly the happenstance of its release and this particular historic moment, means something. So let's get into this. First of all, we can't avoid the controversy that has come up because Bol and Bigelow are both white artists. And this is a movie that is filled with black actors telling a story that takes place in a predominantly black city and deals with white police brutality against black young people. So how do we even begin to formulate our responses to this movie keeping that in mind? Like, I'm not the type of person who says that you can only create art based off of your own personal experience. If that were the case, I couldn't be a novelist because, my God, what a life I've had that is super boring, and how would I ever create anything of any value to anyone?
Sure.
An artist's job is to empathize with someone and then to convey that empathy in a way that hopefully inspires empathy in other people. Or, on the flip side, an artist's job is to entertain you. I believe that this movie was not going for the entertainment value. So, is that in your worldview a problem, or is it just good that this event, which you know I had been glancingly aware of, but did not know most of the specifics about, is it getting any kind of public view, especially nowadays, valuable regardless of from what color artist it comes from?
It's difficult to say because, I mean, this is kind of the question at the center of it is when white people make a film like this and they sell it to who, you know? If you already are racist and bigoted, you're more than likely not going to see this movie. If you are, you know, a defender and supporter of, you know, multiculturalism and everything like that, then you might be seeing this movie. But I'm not sure that this movie is going to convince people one way or the other. And I'm not even sure if that's the idea behind it, if that's the goal, if that's the reason for making a film like this. But just the same, that's kind of the lens that I'm viewing it from, and I just don't know. I think it's a very well-made movie, but I just don't know ultimately what its position is supposed to be, because for the most part, and there are even like little sections where white people kind of become hero figures in a way, which feel, you know, all the more troubling because we know, I think there's no way of getting around the fact that there were a lot of policemen back there that were white, that some of them are good, some of them are bad, and that's just the way kind of the reality is. And so, you know, when you have white people helping black people in this particular predicament, it's hard for that not to feel like the white savior kind of storyline. But, you know, it is what it is. This movie's troubling. This movie's troubling. And what sucks is, in an age where Kathryn Bigelow gets to make a movie like this, most times it would be celebrated because it's another female director doing largely good work, and in an intense kind of adult field. And, you know, if she didn't happen to be white, I think this movie would have a lot more of a different narrative around it. It's just unfortunate that she happens to be one of our premier white female filmmakers. So
it's heartening that this is the year in which female filmmakers are getting a lot of shit. Because in a certain way, it lets you know that they're a part of the Hollywood team now. Because there's rare is the moment where there's not some sort of controversy about a film. And nothing lets you know that you're a token demographic more than no one stopping to question your choices. And so I think in a summer where we have Kathryn Bigelow and
Sophia Coppola
and
Patty Jenkins.
Patty Jenkins didn't really get much of, I guess she got a little bit, but who am I thinking of who did The Bad Batch?
That's
Amanpour.
Lily Amanpour.
Yeah. So in a world where people are not afraid to throw down some, ethical and moral based critiques on these people, I honestly, like, part of me is like, okay, that's great. Like, I'm glad for that. It's an interesting thing that we are allowing ourselves to do that now, to reach that point. Now, obviously no one should ever do that without seeing the movie. That's usually where the bulk of my criticism comes from, is people judging something before they've seen it.
Sure.
Nothing annoys the shit out of me more than people learning about a piece of art that is either being produced or has been produced and then, like, trying to advocate against its creation or exhibition. But now we've seen this movie. And,
I think the other thing that, you know, regardless of whether the race conversation is very important in terms of who is writing and directing this, but I think that becomes all the more egregious when we consider, not even getting into our own opinion, that this is only about this. Like, it would be one thing if this was meant to be, you know, some kind of survey or something, but this stands as a reflection of everything that it's in a way kind of I got some feelings about this movie, so I'm trying to be as I'm trying to be as ambiguous about this as possible. Right. But I think that this goes even beyond conversations we're having about, to make this as broad as possible, like, Well, we've had conversations about identity politics before on this podcast. And again, in some cases, yeah, sure, yes. But this feels so different than those other conversations because it is so fundamentally about those perspectives and telling a clear picture that brings justice to a situation that isn't just about, you know, having characters that represent every form, a walk of life or every perspective. Like, this is so fundamentally about the trauma of, you know, a half dozen Black Americans who were the victims of police brutality that is so explicitly race-based. I mean, it's so interesting even looking at this in relation to Bigelow's other movies. Now, Hurt Locker is less interested in wanting to make like a political statement beyond like personal effects, but Zero Dark Thirty, I understand that there are obviously some people who find like it objectively, you know, problematic. Let's get through that. But there's something about Zero Dark Thirty that it is very much this living debate where, you know, my you know, conservative dad saw that and thought it was, you know, a glorification of
torture.
Yeah, a glorification of torture or whatever specific thing you want to talk about. The point being that that movie is presented so clearly as something that is supposed to represent a spectrum. And this, from minute one, is absolutely meant to be a screed like on the right side of history.
Yeah.
Now, please stop me if like I'm getting overly opinionated, but I just think that very lens makes this very difficult to not neuter itself even before you get into the content of the film, which as well has its own series of complications. Like there's something so frustrating, not only about what you're talking about, Bill, in terms of like cops being heroes, but the fact that this, as you were also kind of alluding, that who the fuck is this for? Because yeah. The audience is not only splintered from the beginning, before you even walk in the door, it's also at once like Blue Lives Matters people are going to be really pissed about this movie. Black Lives Matters people are going to be pissed about this movie. And the average person who's unfamiliar with this might walk out saying, man, this was really horrible. But like it is just so strange that this thing is just kind of I describe this as a mirror of evil. I wrote the review for the film stage, a mirror of evil, but not the universality of it. And I think there is something that is so strangely both an overcompensation and so cowardly about this whole movie. In terms of structure, in terms of the fact that the best part of this movie is in our set piece where characters are brutalized and arguably I understand this. These characters, at least most of them, don't exist beyond whether they live or die by the end of the movie. So I don't know if I'm already getting off track of where we want to go, but I just think that there's a lot to talk about before you even get into the content of this. This is so loaded.
I wanted to start it off with the kind of most obvious thing, the thing that I'd heard the most about, which was, is it right for, you know, white artists to tell this story? My general answer, in general, from a day-to-day standpoint, you know, any kind of story filtered through any person's perspective is yes.
Sure.
Now, my answer for this movie, having seen it, no. I was watching this movie. I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. I felt so clearly for one of the, like, cause maybe it's just her and Mark Bowles' limitations, as creatives, they kind of try to go for a journalistic sense. They've said, sure, you know, people have described this and Zero Dark Thirty as like cinematic
docudrama.
Yeah. And in that way, it reminds me in terms of both, you know, from a historical narrative and the type of story that it's telling and even its aesthetics, a movie, one of, I think it was Paul Greengrass's first film, called Bloody Sunday.
Yeah, I think that was the first one.
Yeah, and so that is about the murder of North Irish protesters by the British military. And that happened in 1972, so 5 years after this film's events. And that is very much like this film. It is handheld, it is gritty, it is grainy. You were dropped into the middle of it. The exposition is minimal. And you follow a set of characters and just kind of watch this thing unfold. Now, Paul Greengrass...
Also, Greengrass is regular cinematographer on this as well, Barry Aykroyd.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I did not realize that. That makes a lot of sense. Because watching this, I just could not get out of my head. The vision of Bloody Sunday was like playing constantly. Now, differences. And this actually might be a similarity. Is Paul Greengrass was born in England. So he, like Kathryn Bigelow, is of the side that is the aggressor, her being white and him being English. The differences, I think, are that Paul Greengrass's film kind of seeks to speak about the societal collisions and to inform the aftermath of the event, whereas Bigelow and Bowl seem to have, they have like a pretense of giving a kind of societal overview, but the movie, mm-hmm, after a pretty compelling like first half hour, really ratchets down into a very narrow story that becomes like a horror movie. And I think that that is the wrong way to go. I think that, uh-huh, you know, mm-hmm, like Bloody Sunday, the shooting starts and it's harrowing and it's horrifying, but it's not horror. It is a kind of unflinching look at this moment, and that allows you to understand the greater outside influences that it exerted. This
is a sober, unironic Hanukkah.
A sober, unironic Hanukkah? Oh, Hanukkah, yeah, the filmmaker.
Hanukkah. Sorry, how do you pronounce his name?
No, it's Michael Hanukkah. Yeah, I heard Hanukkah. Yeah. I was like, I don't quite understand.
I heard Hanukkah.
I'm sorry about that.
Your fault.
It's not Christmas time yet. I'm not sure.
But so like,
still hot outside.
So for the first, like I said, like the first half hour of this movie is super interesting because it keeps a kind of diffuse perspective and it lives up to the name Detroit. Now, the problem is that because it has to get to the Algiers Hotel and because, mm-hmm, it has to spend so much time making you live basically a real-time recreation of that event,
yeah,
it dances over so much essential context to the point where I felt really bad about myself watching this movie, not because, mm, I was thinking, oh, this is my people doing this, but because I kept thinking, why the hell is anyone doing anything that they're doing? Like, I saw the riots start, and I thought to myself, why are you looting a shop in your neighborhood? Like, why are you burning down your neighborhood? Which is the type of thing that any, I'm not going to say ignorant, but, well, I guess I can go with ignorant. Any ignorant white person, like, I live 30 minutes from Baltimore when the riots happened there over the course of a couple days. I think it was last year or 2 years ago. And I was actually there the day before that happened. And, you know, people were watching the news and saying, like, why on earth would you do this to the place that you live? Like, why would you, mm-hmm, decide to burn it all down? And a movie like this gives an artist the opportunity to help people understand the context that makes that happen. Because you can be told, you know, it's a reaction to years of systematic oppression to where the only thing that you can think to do is violence, which is a valid statement, but it's nothing that I can empathize with because I'm lucky to have never had to experience that. And so,
I mean, to her credit, she tries to engage with this.
I think a little bit, because at one point they are kind of screaming at this political figure.
Yeah, I think he's the representative.
And one of them basically says, "We have been nonviolent to this point, and it hasn't gotten us anywhere. Now's the time for violence."
But that's the other thing, Bill, is that She dives right in at the point where they decide to become violent. Like, I think the movie could have used more context.
I don't know. I mean, I think the most interesting thing that this film does in a way is it takes and it makes that narrative of the history of kind of America and specifically Detroit, and it puts it in perspective in that opening kind of sequence, which is fantastic. It is beautiful. I don't know who did the drawings, and it's based on
Jacob Lawrence's Migration series. I really felt like
that was tonally misjudged for what the movie becomes,
especially coming from a white director.
Yeah.
For what it becomes, yes.
I rarely, if ever, say the word appropriation. You know, because cultural appropriation is the story of the evolution of any culture. But that moment felt super appropriative, and it was as though it felt. What's the word I'm looking for? Pandering? It was just very strange. And maybe it's just the limitation of cinema, but like, you can't try to pack something like 30 years worth of history, you know, because this movie, like, pretty much that opening begins with the great.
Also, it's not her story to tell.
Right.
that's irrelevant.
But again, you know, I'll say, so Paul Haggis directed every episode of Show Me a Hero.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a brilliant miniseries. Like, and that miniseries gave light and voice to so many different disparate ideas and concepts and people that through every stroke of the narrative brush, I understood exactly what was happening, and I understood the pain and the resentment on both sides. And this movie, I think through its attempt to be as cinema verite as possible, gets a lot wrong, especially because it still knows that it has to give some context as to what's going on, and it does it in the cutesiest, most appropriative way possible, and it begins it with a sour taste in my mouth, and then it only gets worse once we see how the riot starts, and then it only gets worse once we're in that hotel.
And then it becomes even more complicated when even the most fleshed out characterizations are still based in stereotypes of the time period. Like, arguably the most characterized character is he was one of the main singers in the Motown group, the Dramatics. And it follows, you know, right before his moment to shine, the theater that they're about to play at is evacuated because of the riots. Yeah. But, like, there's something really, and I guess I can get to something even later with his coda, but there's something so, like, frighteningly reductive about the fact that this is one of our most fleshed out characters, and he's still thin enough to be only a, you know, like, rising star archetype.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's so strange about, but, like, sorry, I mentioned that specifically because that's so strange about the weird combination of Bigelow and Bull, which is what made it so great in the sense that Bigelow knows genre cinema. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when you look at Until Dark and Point Break and Strange Days, like, she knows how to make characters say, you know, they're not super fleshed out, but she knows how to make them feel really important. But then that bumps up against Bowles, like, very, as you're saying, journalistic cinema verite intention. Yeah. And it's that weird thing. And that's that clash.
Yeah.
I think this film really, Brian, I think you're kind of nailing it, is that this film runs up against, it has to have a runtime. It can't be a 3.5 hour film. And, I say it can't be, certainly it can. We've seen right. 3.5 hour it's films,
possible, sure.
But not to tell a story in the mainstream like this. I think this might be better as a documentary or as a docuseries, something mm-hmm. along those lines. Maybe a made-for-TV miniseries, something along those lines versus what it ultimately ends up becoming. Because especially the last 30 minutes of this film feel so rushed and feel so harried, and it feels like such a whimper compared to the fact that we basically spend, like Michael was saying, an hour on a set piece inside the Algiers Motel. And it's like, what is going on right now? Why are we spending this much time in such a torturous, horrific way? And then just kind of like, okay, and here's the end.
Yeah.
You know, this film just has a lot of issues throughout. And
well, I kind of want to pose a question related to exactly what you just said, Bill. I was trying as a thought experiment to think about this. What if this was only the set piece? Would that make this a better movie? Is it because it's trying to bite off so much?
I don't know what you mean by if it was only the set because honestly, if this film was an hour and a half of just that sequence inside the Algiers, I would have torn my hair out, and I don't have very long hair. I shaved my head. Yes, I would have plucked it individually.
And you don't even have your mustache anymore, so you couldn't grab exactly. your mustache and tear it out.
Yeah, it just would not – it would be such a rough, rough experience to go through an hour and a half of that set piece. And I understand that's not what you're specifically kind of like putting up as a question, but that's kind of the reality of it is, holy shit, if this was an hour and a half of just that, oh my god, this movie would be a heart attack.
It is very much the things around that, though, that contribute to why it feels extra hollow. At least in my mind, it is not spending enough time on the things early on, that context that Brian's talking about, as well as after. And there would have been, you know, I see exactly what you're saying, Bill, but there is something just so weirdly dishonest about the way that this is being presented. And again, I guess I'm not being objective about this, but I just think that there is, and even it's not useful to be speculative about this, but I still think that it's so strangely paced into these three very distinct, very disparate sections, that it does become a different conversation when you start thinking about like hacking off the sections and what this movie is even trying to be.
Yeah, I mean, here's my problem. I think that you shouldn't, this movie about these people and about this incident shouldn't involve this incident. It should pick up afterwards. It should, I think having that however long section it is gives you a false feeling of climax, and then the movie I think knows it, and then it feels the mm-hmm. necessity to like kind of coast through this epilogue. And we know that police kill black people. You know, I don't think that the manner by which they do it matters. I think that whether it be after 40 minutes of psychologically torturing them and illegally detaining them, or within a split second at a traffic stop when a person's reaching for their wallet, that is just, it's a banal thing to depict. I think that what's sure. more interesting is, and what really most people are trying to focus on is this, like most people today, most activists are trying to focus on, is the systemic structures that make that a thing that happens and then rarely, if ever, gets prosecuted. And mm-hmm. and I think that one of the more interesting stories about this, like I get it, like it's a harrowing thing, and but I don't think you're doing a service to these people's lives by turning the last moments of their short young lives into
yes.
basically a chair gripping exercise in cinema verite tension. You know, it's weird. I don't like it. You know,
it's also weird that it's really good. Like yeah. as far as technically, it's like Bloody Sunday
fantastic. Again. Like, the shots happen, and you're seeing people fall, and they're not people you've been following. But you are. It's the Dunkirk effect, I guess, is what I'll call it. You are following a certain amount of people, who are just ciphers to give you an entry point into the viewpoint of these people. And so you're not reveling in the concept of who's going to live, who's going to die, like what's going to happen. And apparently there was like a perfect thing that you could have made a movie about that would have given you the opportunity to evince the facts of the case as they're known and to really delve into the way it impacted the community and all these other things. And that was the People's Tribunal that was held afterwards. I don't even know if anyone knows about this because the movie didn't talk about it. But I was doing research on this because I wanted to know how much was real and how much was fake. And I found out about this thing, the People's Tribunal on the Algiers Motel killings. And there's this website. It's the rosaparksbiography.org. And then it's a chapter within that. And the community held a People's Tribunal where they, you know, in a completely not unlawful, but had no impact in the law kind of way, came together and had a trial. And the community found these police officers guilty. Like, they had a jury, they had lawyers, and they found them guilty. And of course, that didn't lead to anything happening.
Sure.
Like, because obviously they didn't care. Like, the entire point was that they knew that the press and the police weren't going to make anything out of this. And so they had this thing set up where they brought in a bunch of people to be on a jury. And they held it in a church. And among the people selected to be jurors, and the reason it's on the Rosa Parks biography.org, is that Rosa Parks was one of the jurors. I mean, that is a story. Like, that is a meaningful, that is the real unknown thing that you could really latch onto. But instead, you know, what we basically have here is a movie that says a bunch of racist cops abused and murdered some black people who lived in Detroit, and they got away with it without making any grander statement. And with giving a context around it that makes me feel like it is saying anything meaningful.
That's the biggest flaw I think of this film is I didn't learn anything. I didn't come out changed by any way. If you go in feeling a certain way, you're probably going to come out feeling that exact same way. I mean, it may make you a little bit more angry about the whole situation, but it's not going to give you any new insight into how our justice system works or things like that. And I think, you know, there's been so many things, whether it's making a murder or what was the other one? Even Serial and all of these other things that really kind of delve and teach you a lot more about how our criminal justice system works. Even O.J. Made in – or it's – is it O.J. Made in
America?
Yeah. Is that the documentary or is that the TV series? I keep forgetting which one's which.
O.J. Made in America is the documentary.
Is the TV series.
Okay, cool. You know, O.J. Made in America is also a good, like, you know, turning up the leaf and kind of like uncovering how our justice system works and everything like that. So I think this film has that ability because Brian, like you're saying, that sounds really fucking fascinating. That mm-hmm. And this film doesn't touch on that at all. And I feel like that's such a missed opportunity. That's something that could have really been interesting to kind of watch and learn about. I don't even know then, though, that I would have felt better about watching a film like this, but certainly I would have learned something, you know?
Yeah.
I would have come away with some new information beyond just people are shitheads.
I think the closest that this does come, and I think this also speaks to a problem of the film, is I think some of – for me, some of the most cinematically interesting things involved John Boyega's character, Melvin Dismukes, and the way that he is a perspective that fits fits in the middle. As a security guard, he is – you know, he's not seen as a threat by predominantly white military and cops.
He's treated very weirdly in this film.
I think that Bull and Bigelow both realize that there's something interesting to be mined there. Like one of my favorite scenes, for instance, is early on where he decides to bring coffee over mm-hmm. to a military unit. And they like hesitantly take it. But this comes literally after another scene where they almost – where a like adjacent police unit almost kills a young black boy on the street who was, you know, angry about how he was being treated and almost died in the process. And so I mentioned these two things because I think Bull and Bigelow did realize that they had a very interesting perspective here. Now the problem then as well is – that what that leads to is, you know, at the Algiers Hotel, there's some kind of interesting, almost Nuremberg-esque, how can evil happen like this, while also fully recognizing these people as evil, in the sense of him having to, like, stand beside and negotiate that middle ground. But, like, that story is not really relevant to this larger context of trying to create this in a lineage of police brutality. Like it's this bizarre, you know, like misunderstanding. It's really hard to not think that this movie was something else entirely at some point, because it's such a weird attempt to put, you know, irregular jigsaw pieces together in that sense. But like that doesn't mean that those are the things that I found the most interesting, right, in the way that to negotiate that middle ground and surprise that grayness, you know, the thing that, for instance, Zero Dark Thirty was at least, you know, was constantly trying to have a surface of at least being ambiguous about these things.
I feel like my other main issue with this movie and its presentation comes down to the moments when the movie breaks through, by which I mean there are a lot of scenes in this that have a very you are there kind of feeling. A lot of the scenes that take place during the riots, a lot of the scenes that take place in the incredibly overcrowded police station.
Oh,
they
yeah.
have a noise and a freneticism to them, and a kind of blunt, a blunt delivery that feels real. It's interesting. I have not had enough time to vet all the details of this movie. So at this point, I'm going to speaking purely about in the narrative of the movie. The kind of ringleader cop is brought in by homicide because earlier that day he shot someone and they died.
In the back with a shotgun.
Yeah. And the homicide detective says, I'm going to recommend like a murder charge to the DA. So enjoy your life and go back out on the streets.
Yeah. It basically paints the picture that they are so overwhelmed right now that they literally cannot do anything to this cop outside of due process. Right. And due process is so backloaded right now that due process is going to probably take another month, you know? And it's like, so in the meantime, I can't do anything to you except tell you you did a shitty thing. I guess go back on your job.
If I were going to fire everyone who had done something wrong in the past 36 to 48 hours, I would have no one left on the force. So,
yeah,
go for it. And that's like that's a moment where you think, oh, my God, A, that's the kind of systematic nonsense that gets people killed. And B, that's the kind of like interior rot that just allows someone like that to even become a cop in the first place. So that's a good scene. But then you have a scene.
That's
sure.
Part of that is the union system, right?
And it's
the unionization of the police force and how it's turned this thing into, hey, you're shitty at your job, you should get fired, into, no, you can't fire him just because he's shitty at his job. Yeah. You have to do more than that. And it's like, well, what? No. Why?
Thank you, because we all know that I'm nothing if not a union buster. you know, get me born 100 years earlier and I'd be a Pinkerton. But yeah, I mean, like, for all the good unions have done, that is a problem with every union. But, you know, any system that's designed to insulate people will lead to corruption and things like that. We don't have to get into our thoughts on unions right now. Now, the opposite of a scene like that is the moment when everyone is up in that utmost room and... One of the guys.
Let me ask this, and just so I have clarification, so the audience going forward has clarification. This doesn't actually take place in the Algiers. Isn't this a neighboring building?
This is an annex of the Algiers. So it is under the management of the Algiers, but it is known. They call it the Algiers. Annex. They call it.
Okay, so it's like the budget version of the annex or of the Algiers. It's just located very close, and that's it.
So I had like looked it up to try to like understand what it was. And what I'd seen via Wikipedia is that it was a 3-story detached home that was behind it that had kind of been post converted into a place just so they could rent more rooms.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So again, under the management of the Algiers. And technically part of the Algiers, but it is the annex and not the U-shaped Algiers proper around the pool.
Sure.
That's something that honestly probably needs a little bit of clarity in the movie, even if it's a single line or something.
She says, like, we only have room in the annex. It's, like, down the breezeway. And
That supposes that you know what the hell an annex is and everything along those lines, which I clearly do not. And I was like, okay, what?
It's kind of hilarious that that's the only line from Samira Wiley as well, and maybe the only black woman in the entire movie who gets a line of dialogue.
Well, there's the girl. Yeah,
there's a couple of
and then a
female
couple of, like grandmothers who are, you know, it's
That's right. All right.
Yes. It is distressing the way in which black women are kind of, but again, you know, historical accuracy. You know, you have to take the facts that are given to you. And it is true that there were no black women in the Algiers annex at the time that this happened. So like But, like, again, if you wanted to ameliorate that problem, set it during the People's Tribunal.
But I think the other – sorry, I keep saying the other thing because there are a lot of things that apparently grind my gears in this movie. the thing about, you know, Krauss, which is the – who's played by Will Poulter and is the, you know, just kind of the psychotic
– the ringleader. Yeah.
But what's even more distressing about the two other cops that he has with them is that you know, as you're saying, there is this weird journalistic integrity, but those are also three cops who are such a clean spectrum of like white supremacy tendencies. You know, you have the cop who believes that they need to teach the black community a lesson. You know, you have Jack Rayner's character who's blindly obedient to the other cop who is for a long time in the movie goes into a rant with two white women about how they're having sex with black women and how dare them. Like there's something so clean that like immediately kind of takes you out of the movie.
Yeah,
in the moment, and it's constant those back and forth
sides like that. I mean, well, what I was gonna say is when everyone is in that room, and the guy gives like the monologue about what it's like to be black to a bunch of black people. It felt a little weird. Like it felt like the movie was okay. Well, we have to make this one point excessively clear because that's going to be our thesis. And the line, like, you know, living as a black person in America is like living with a gun in your face, is a good one. But it feels out of place in a movie that other times goes very far to like not.
That would be a given.
Yeah. And
like other movies.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, I have a lot of trouble, like, I just setting everything, especially because we don't know a lot of what happened in the hotel, makes it harder to reconcile the idea that this movie is trying to say something. Because when you, I'll give you an anecdote. I was trying to find out exactly how real this movie was in terms of what happens in the hotel. Mm-hmm. And I guess we can talk spoilers later. There is a person in this movie who is killed, and I found four different rundowns of this incident. Four different, not like a fan blog or something, but like real.
Wait, you got to give
testimony.
You got to give the context for this though, Brian. Well, like, this is very weirdly pieced together.
Right.
Like, and that's. So, discussed in the movie.
Yeah, like, and the problem with that is that, like, I can look at four different fairly academic sources, and two will say one thing and two will say the other. Two said that someone was killed during the initial raid, and two said that that same person was actually seen alive afterwards before they died. And I was just, like, I was blown away to the point where I literally did a Google search that simply asked, when did, and then insert real life person's name, die? And I was just brought to more articles that seemed to have completely different answers. And
well, I think
kind of uncertainty, when you filter it through the omniscient camera here, leads to less uncertainty. And that makes the outcome afterwards a lot cleaner because you know that these cops just got off. But it also makes it a little less interesting and a little less thought-provoking, because all you have to do is pat yourself on the back for saying, I know they did it, I saw them do it. Like, what we're struggling with as a nation right now is we can have a video of a cop shooting someone and people will still say, well, he probably had his reasons. So what you need to do is remove any moment where you show that and then just write your fucking ass off to make it so that even without visual confirmation, you can still get an audience to the place where they say, no, he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you were to remove the camera from this hotel, like fade out when they first run in and then do everything afterwards, I think that you will find that would be a lot better for the movie and the case it's trying to make. Because there's nothing challenging or interesting about watching something happen in a movie and then having the movie show how the people got away with it. All you have to do is say, well, I know they did it and I can feel good because I'm better than those jurors. But like,
but it's not even about
they
that.
Didn't see what you did. Yeah. Like,
it still goes like 20 minutes after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a bizarre thing. And the other bizarre thing is that the movie is very well made.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm upset at how well made this movie is, because
that's what I struggled with in my review.
it's like you see a building and you go, my God, that is a gorgeous building. What do they do in there? And then you find out it's a CIA black site, and you're like, well, fuck. That's not good.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think you're right, Brian, because definitely the issue here in a lot of ways is kind of, you know, they could have gone down a lot of different routes. They could have gone down multiple angles. There's one kind of angle that they kind of chase a little bit involving John Boyega's character that they never really kind of follow up and like retread on. And I was really upset by that because like something very noticeable happens to him after the aftermath of this. And they never really kind of like clear up what the heck happened. So it's interesting that they had the opportunity to chase down kind of multiple angles and multiple kind of versions of this story, and they chose to go with one that has kind of an omniscient, you know, narrative mm-hmm. perspective that is just completely and utterly false. You know, it's like that doesn't exist, because obviously there are so many differing narratives, and that's just the nature of when you ask somebody what happens, especially in a high stress situation like this. You know, it's very easy for them to be coerced. It's very easy for them to be. This is one of the reasons why, you know, you learn when you start doing research and kind of digging into some of this stuff, why testimony is so effective to jury members and yet so nearly always false in either the overall thing that they're recounting or minor details that could be major details in a criminal or, you know, civil case or something along those lines, right? Yeah. One of the things that we've learned is that the more you repeat a story, the less accurate it actually becomes. Yeah. It's kind of like a record, right? A LP, sure. A vinyl record. The more you play it over, the less accurate it becomes, the less clear it becomes. And so during jury testimony, you have to grill down and constantly repeat yourself. And if anything changes, if you start remembering things a little bit differently, well, then that changes everything.
Well, and yeah, the way that I've heard it put, you know, just for the just to throw this out there, is like, you know, you have a memory, and let's say, you know, you have to remember it, which means you have to dredge it up, and then you have to put it back out there. You have to destroy it to fit it through the very narrow filter of your perception, and then you have to put it back together. And in putting it back together, you may accidentally put something in the wrong place. Or you may start to put in, on your next recollection, you'll remember the last time you remembered that story, and suddenly it's raining instead of sunny.
Yes.
Because the memory of remembering it influences the memory itself, because you've that statue that you destroyed and then recreated wherever you recreated it last.
Or that person that's asking you these questions might lead you in a way. They might say, wasn't there broken glass on the ground when you came into the room? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh yeah, I remember the broken glass.
There is.
And from that point on, your memory is forever tied that there was broken glass when you entered that room.
There is,
and
that's a brilliant episode of This American Life about that. And mm-hmm. it's actually about a cop who realizes that he did that to someone.
Yes.
And like helps them get out and just like feels fucking terrible about it.
Well, I think that's the thing as well, is that this movie just is constantly filled with that anxiousness in terms of like it's not willing to do to even like, you know, pose any of those possibilities that, as you're saying, it's it's not omniscient, because then that could also open it up to the possibility that it's in any way not against the actions of the cops. Like, I think that is what happened here is, you know, the more you think about it, like, this movie has been like, you know, it's been constructed in such a way that, as you're saying, it preaches the converted. It's not going to change anybody's mind. It's not going to make you think about anything, but it doesn't totally fuck it up. Like, it's
like if what you want is a dramatic recreation of these particular people's best idea of what happened in the Algiers Hotel motel.
Sure.
Then fine. This is good for you. It's surrounded by a bunch of other stuff that your mileage will vary on. But yeah, I mean, that's it. And what's funny is that, like, Zero Dark Thirty was a process movie. You know, it was following a specific person. I think she was amalgamated from like two actual CIA analysts. But it gave you the idea of how this information was gotten. Now, whether you want to say that it condones torture or not, I think that you can depict something without condoning it. Sure. Also, in my view, in that movie, the torture didn't get them what they want. It was stopping the torture and treating the person like a real person. Now, would you have been able to do that if they hadn't been tortured first? I don't know. But it ends with the set piece that is giving you what you came to see. It is saying, okay, I'm going to show you how we killed Bin Laden. First, though, I got to show you how we got to the point where we could.
Sure.
And that works. Now, this movie takes that same basic idea, but applies it to something that you in no way want to have to experience. And then it very quickly runs past the rest of it.
Well, I think the Bin Laden thing as well is treated. I think it'd be really interesting to actually do a shot by shot examination between the Zero Dark Thirty Bin Laden raid and the Algiers sequence in this. I think that they're very much using a lot of the same techniques in terms of especially editing. Like, it's been a little while, obviously, since I've seen Zero Dark Thirty, but it is interesting as well that, like, that sequence is pretty horrifying as well. But you're right, Brian, like, that is payoff after a long, long discussion of other things that are constantly building up to that. Where this is like a weird deconstruction, but it's not really sure what it's deconstructing or how Algiers shows this, other than like in like the what happens to characters and what happens in the Algiers is not actually reflective of its larger thesis. Only like the broad strokes are reflective of something that can then be then very vaguely attached to larger conversations.
So where do we go from here? I mean, I have other things to say about this movie. I also have another fun story about how going to a theater, it can sometimes be awful.
Yeah, what was your guys' reaction? I saw this at a critic screening, so it's
I saw
less exciting.
There was, you know, there were smatterings of, oh, like, it's terrible. But, like, oddly, like, it was, people were, like, oddly unmoved, it felt. I did have to contend with a guy who kept falling asleep next to me and snoring very loudly.
Brad, you need a new theater.
I saw this in the same theater where I saw Zero Dark Thirty. And during that screening, I had the heroin addicts who were talking in between nodding off next to me and who were the ones who said, I thought they found him in a cave in the ground. And I turned to them and said, no, you're thinking of Saddam Hussein. And then I thought to myself, oh my God, why am I engaging with them? No, this time I was the only white person in the theater. The guy next to me kept falling asleep and snoring really loudly. Like, you know how, like, sometimes someone snores so loud and you just think there must be something wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously this person has sleep apnea or something. Sure. Some sort of breathing disorder. And his wife kept waking him up. I assume she's his wife. It might have been his girlfriend. And so he kept waking up, but then he would fall asleep again. And then he'd wake up, and then he'd see one thing on the screen. And then, as though to try to play it off like he wasn't sleeping, he would say what was happening on the screen. And so, after, like, and, you know...
Oh, man.
I usually would say something a lot sooner, you know, but I'm not about to do that during this movie for whatever reason. But finally, I can't stand it anymore, and I poked him in the arm when he was snoring, because I guess his wife had given up. And he wakes up, and he says, like, what? And I said, I'm sorry, you were snoring really loudly. And he said, what? I thought he couldn't hear me, so I said, I'm sorry, you were snoring. And he then gets louder and says, what? And I said, I'm really sorry, but you were snoring really loudly. And then I can't repeat most of what he said to me because it was a lot of cursing and a lot of uses of the N-word. And he is furious at me. And then when his wife tries to get him down, he becomes furious at his wife. And he takes out his phone and starts texting some people. I don't know why he's texting people. I don't know why he's still in the theater. If he's texting,
oh,
I guess, because it should also be noted that earlier in the screening, he had also taken a phone call on the speakerphone. And then with, like, around the time that the Algiers Hotel incident is done, finally, he stands up, and this is one of those theaters where you have the reclining seats. So I hear the buzz of his, like, footstool part going down. And the entire time that he's putting the footstool down, he's staring at me, and I'm just trying to watch the movie. And then he walks over to me and stands next to me and just stares down at me. And I look up at him and I slowly put my footstool down and I said, I'm sorry, did you want to leave? And he did. But I didn't realize, because he was basically laying down, which is why he kept falling asleep, that this man had a good half foot and 100 pounds on me. So I was deeply concerned for a little while, because he wasn't talking like a guy who was just annoyed. His wife had to continuously push him back down into his seat for the first 15 minutes after I had awoken him. Which I get. Yeah. I'm pissed off when I wake up, but, like, I'm not about to fight someone over it. But it's just, you know, I got to stop going to this theater is basically the point of that story. But in general, everyone else in the audience was kind of like, oh, okay. Yeah, I get you. Like, I was expecting, like, a lot more. And in fact, Birth of a Nation had a better response in the same theater than this movie did. Huh. From the crowd.
There were some aghast faces, but I will say that me and the person next to me said, what the fuck, when a certain actor showed up near the end of this movie.
Oh, would that be John Krasinski?
That would be John Krasinski.
Sure. Yeah, he walked in, I'm like, is that John fucking Krasinski?
Yep.
Yeah.
Should we get into spoilers? What should we do here?
I want to get into spoilers because I want to talk about one particular nit I want to pick with this film that sure. I'm curious to see your reactions to and stuff like that.
Yeah, that can be how we wrap up. As we go in, we pick Bill's one nit, and then we because I feel like there's not a lot else to talk about. We have totally dismantled this movie. So spoilers, yes. I guess, for Bill to bring up a nit that we can pick or not pick. So Bill, what is your nit?
So much of the violence and much of the torture that surrounds the incident in the Algiers is one of these cops basically saying, I am going to continuously push y'all and push your buttons and do all this evil shit to you because you won't tell me where this gun was located and who was shooting it and was it coming from our building or your building or not. And it seems like such a narrative misstep because, you know, again, Brian, you can maybe fill me in on the details, but why the fuck wouldn't they just tell him, hey, yes, there was a guy with a fake gun shooting at y'all. Now let's all go home and be normal. Why is this something that's just kind of in, because in the film they portray the fact that this guy died. So it's not like I'm ratting him out and he's going to get in trouble. He's right. Dead. In this film. So I'm just so confused by why all of this kind of look.
Why it needs to happen.
I'm not excusing what happens, because what happens is terrible and fucking awful, but I'm just curious why it feels like there's so much more to it than just, oh, we don't want to rat out the guy that got us all in this fucking terrible situation to begin with. Like, that seems like such an obvious thing to just be like, hey, it was
This is what I was going to bring sure. up earlier when I said this movie made me feel bad about myself. Because, like, first I saw the riots and I was like, why on earth would you do that? And then throughout the entire Algiers Hotel thing, I just kept thinking, why hasn't anyone even said it was a cap gun, like it was a starter yes. pistol, and the dead guy did it. Like,
and I think it has two purposes.
And then at that point, like, the cops can just still suck and be monsters and not believe them.
Sure,
because they never found the starter pistol. That is a real fact.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where it went. It seems like they should have found it. I don't know. Anyway, Michael, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had that same thought. But I definitely interpreted that as an intentional thing that was not successful, but at least trying to make a larger thematic point that there's not even a possibility for a conversation. But as you're saying, Brian, why wouldn't they have someone explicitly say there was no gun? But it's been a little while, but I am kind of...
They actually do say that.
There is no gun, right?
There's no gun, and then he's like, did anyone see a gun? And everyone's like, no, I never saw any gun. And I'm like, literally everyone in that room has seen a gun.
Yes. And what they end up saying, the two white women towards the end of this kind of sequence, well, I guess it's not even the end of the sequence. Anyways, they at some point say, and if he did have a gun, it was a fake gun anyways. And you're like, wait, why didn't you fucking say that earlier?
Yeah.
Like, why didn't you just say that? Why is nobody saying anything in this fucking movie? And it's driving me insane. And I understand that if you're put into a very stressful situation, I understand that there can be a lot of like confusing things done. But he is literally saying, we heard gunshots from this apartment, hotel thing, whatever the fuck.
Right, they're right? Dealing with snipers in this city. Like, there are real snipers out there. In fact, something I looked up said that earlier in the day, a police officer had actually been killed. A police officer. Yeah. This sounds crazy, but he was actually going to retire in 2 days and start working at the IBM plant. And so, the cops who were already on edge were even more on edge. Again, not giving them an out. That's not an out. That's not a reason to do what they were doing. But it is context for it, and I don't understand, because there is a point where one of the guys says, officer, can I please say something? And the officer's like, yes, please, oh my god, let's talk. And the kid says, I think you have the wrong house. And I'm like, sure. You know he doesn't have the wrong house. You heard the guy shooting. And and this is why I hate this movie a little bit, because I don't want to be the type of person who has those thoughts.
Yes. Right? I don't either.
Guy who's like, this wouldn't have happened to you if you had just fucking said something. But the movie does very little to set up in my mind why they wouldn't. And I feel like there should have been a point, because in the trial, they talk about the starter's pistol. And I want to know, I want someone to ask the question, why didn't you say anything to the cops? And then they could even just say, we were so scared of the trouble we'd get in with the starter pistol that we thought that we could say nothing. And then it went so far that suddenly saying anything now would just get us in more trouble. So we were hoping for the best and it would all blow over. But that's like not what is given to me by the movie in those moments.
Yeah.
It reminds me.
It doesn't give me that at all.
It reminds me at times of like you know, like the footage from like the Stanford prison experiment. Like there, I think that is what the movie is trying to get across, is that that fear is so ingrained that even the possibility of saying something, that is how I interpret it. I'm not saying that's a satisfying answer, but I think the movie is not really sidestepping that question, but is engaging it with it in such a way that it is obviously going to make you question, why is this not even brought up? And it is weirdly another example of how flat this is, that you mentioned, Brian, that there actually was a sniper earlier in that day, because how they show it in the movie is that it is just some random apartment which they shoot. I forgot why the military shoots that
because the little girl like looked through her blinds.
That's right.
The window, and then I guess we're to assume that little girl is dead.
Yeah, we don't even see like the result of that.
But that's another like playing both sides thing. Like by then like hedging the bets against, or I'm sorry, not hedging the bets, by you know making the military just totally paranoid without like any reason. Like it's another example of just like not saying anything at all. Like not making these characters into, you know, like missed opportunities. Like it just feels so strange.
Yeah. I really don't. I don't quite get it. Like I almost want to learn more about the incident itself, because I feel bad that this is my only like real in-depth knowledge about it, because like I hate walking around like
sure.
wondering, like it's a movie, why didn't they say anything?
Yeah,
like
we got six documentaries about the 92 riots, and I'm not sure what else has been done about this.
Yeah, it's crazy. There is a book that was written like very shortly after this all happened called The Algiers Motel Incident by John Hersey, I think it's called. That's apparently very good, though it has gotten some criticism because it was put out so quickly that it feels a little slapdash. But the guy like interviewed everyone, like interviewed the shit out of people.
Since we're in spoilers, should we talk about, I mean, we've talked around, I don't know, I feel like we've done spoilers literally this whole time.
Well,
but,
so just because we're in spoilers, the person I was talking about who I found out died in two different ways, was
yes.
the guy who died last in the movie, Fred.
Okay.
So like there's, if you look at like Wikipedia and stuff, it says that he was found dead, but like the people who left the motel last remembered seeing him alive, which jives with sort of with the way that it's set up in the movie, though he was killed
sure.
in a different room. He was not with Carl. Now, another way that I've heard it or read it is that he was killed in the initial raid. He was on the phone with his girlfriend. When the police came in, he dropped the phone, and that the two different policemen shot him at the same time and he died. I don't understand how the it can like vary so much. Like one of them must be wrong, but I can't for the life of me figure out which
one. It's understandable why they did that. I mean it's understandable why Bowl and Bigelow picked that first narrative,
yes.
because it, you know, it further goes into
has something for me to read, like a definitive thing, I would love it, because I want to be able to know for certain. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. I know that a lot in this is unknown, but I feel like that's the type of thing that should be easily verifiable. And so if someone could give me something for that. But yeah, Mike, like you were saying, I mean, thematically and narratively, that's a quote unquote satisfying way to kill that character.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, I hate to say that, but
sure.
yeah, you know, having him, you know, refuse
sure.
to say that he didn't see anything and then getting killed by the cop. Cops.
We have every bit of 45 minutes after that moment. What did you say?
Yeah.
Because we have to get John Boyega in jail.
Right.
We have to do a court
yeah,
case.
That's the other thing. What the fuck?
All the parents involved.
What the hell happens there? Why
is he arrested but not charged?
Okay. Yeah. Why?
I don't know.
Because he's framed?
Why? I just don't understand, like, because they actually do a decent job of nailing down the cops and then, like, trying to get testimony out of them that will put them away. Like, they actually do a good job.
Yeah.
In the end.
What I don't understand is why he... I mean, I guess I understand why he lies more than why everyone else lies in the movie. But... again, it's harder to accept a person's lie in a film if you don't fully understand their motivation.
Yeah, and you've was he
seen what happened?
Like, and he doesn't testify.
Dead. Yeah,
and he doesn't testify in the film. And you're like, why aren't you testifying?
But he does
against these cops.
He testified though, but he testified like for them, like to clear them. I think in the movie, like, they make it sound like he went to bat for them.
That's how I saw it as well.
Yeah. And again, I've done quite a bit of research and I don't know that I've figured out if he actually did that.
But even like veracity wise, like just the choice to then do that, then do the court case and then finally do a coda with the dramatic singer wanting to join the church choir. Like, it's, That is an insulting ending. Like, let's be honest here.
It does the Dunkirk thing. We're kind of Dunkirk a lot in this. It does the Dunkirk thing where, like, don't they do all of the post credits cards, like updating you on where everyone is while the choir is singing, and then it like flashes to his face for a half a second.
It does.
Yeah. Okay. So I wasn't delirious. That actually happened. Yeah. I don't understand that. I don't. I really don't. But again,
I have heard some people. I will say that I've heard some people interpret, and I don't agree with this, interpret that whole ending part as almost like a shell shock. Like a reflection of like PTSD. Like the movie itself is like trying to recover. I don't agree with that, but I'm just saying I've heard that interpretation.
That's what the movie should be about, though. Like, that's.
Agreed.
Like I don't need to be there. Like, the guy is a good enough actor that if you had just started the movie with him getting found by that other cop, P.S., who could do this to someone? Worst line of the year.
yeah.
Oh my God.
You know, like, and it's like, I understand, like, there's that weird, like, quiet, like, Angel of Mercy National Guardsman who, like, is on the edges constantly helping.
Yeah.
And then you have like the cop that finds Larry. Larry is his name, I believe.
Yes.
And he's like, oh, who could do this to someone? It's like, you've been fucking watching the city tear itself apart for three days. Like, don't do that. Like, I understand that you want to have at least one good white cop, and, like, you know, the homicide detectives are quote unquote good guys, but they're assholes. So I guess you want to have like a pure angel, but don't have him sound like Ethan Hawke at the beginning of Training Day. Like, you should have him like say, I'm going to get you help, buddy. And then turn to his partner and have him say something like, this shithole's going to fucking hell. Like reflect some of the weight of what's going on.
It's even formally, that's just a terrible decision in the sense that, like, you watch him like weave under like around a fence under like a gnarled gate, and then it does a close-up when that scene happens.
Yeah.
Just a zoom in on that officer right as they say it. Like, it's such a bizarre reiteration of trying to be on the right side of history.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, like, the homicide detective comes out and says, this is like a counterpoint to that. The homicide detective comes out when the one guy's trying to run away and he's like, get out of the car, you racist fuck. And I'm like, yeah, all right, that sounds about right.
Sure.
Like, I can get behind that because honestly, like, you're a homicide detective. You've probably been working a lot recently. Like, and you don't give a shit if some fucking patrolman. He's not your police, like, so you're gonna fucking be pissed off at him. especially because so many people in this movie fail to act because they don't want to be involved in a civil rights problem.
Sure. There's a really great, I do have to say, that military scene where they're like,
the police and the military are both like,
exactly,
we're just going to go.
We're going to wash our hands of this. Yeah. Like that stuff is interesting. And I think those are scenes that do like contribute or feed into this larger idea that it is about something bigger. But yeah, I mean, you can't really, you can't isolate that from everything else. Like, that's not how that works.
Yeah. And yeah. I didn't realize this. The Dramatics are the band that did What You See Is What You Get.
Mm.
I don't know if that means anything to anyone else, but all right.
Yeah, they sing that song. So
did they sing What You See Is What You Get?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, because that was
I'm as real as real can be, or something like that. Yeah,
I don't think that's the same one.
Oh, that's not the same one.
I don't know, but I know this that was a hit in the 70s, and I guess I only really know the chorus of that. But anyway,
okay.
What was I gonna say? I think that's all I've got, in all honesty.
Do you guys have anything else positive to say about this movie?
The problem is, like, if this, even if, I don't know, it's like, it's such a well-made movie. Like, the cinematography is beautiful. The staging is great. Like, the you really feel a kind of verisimilitude in the image. And then the story happens and everything kind of falls to fucking pieces. And that's with me not really understanding what was going on to begin with. Like, I feel like by skimping out, by just having this, the blind pig, the After Hours Club, that bust up happens, and then you have all these people in the street, and the cops are like, we got to get out of here because these people are going to get unruly, and then the cops leave, and then a riot starts. And it's like, okay, but I don't quite get it. Like, I don't, like, I understand in an academic sense, but you, like, it, as I said earlier, I think I opened the podcast saying it, you know, the job of an artist should be to create a situation in which you were forging empathy with a character or a situation. And I never felt that beyond the visceral disgust that I felt at watching people get abused by people in a position of power. And I don't think that is the best way that this movie could have gone.
It's also a little bit weird that the two characters who get the most catharsis are arguably the two white women, Caitlin Dever and Hannah Murray. Hannah Murray's characters, like, when they are finally get away and are in, like, this other part of the Algiers, like, there's this moment where the camera just, like, is trained on them for a few seconds as they are just, like, you know, grasping each other after this horrible event. Yeah. And it's kind of weird that they are the only characters that get that.
Everyone else just runs into the night, never to be heard from again, until the trial starts. And what's crazy is that, like, you know, that in that coda at the with the Larry, like, there's like four great stories happening in that, and none of them are the story of this movie, and none of them are given any amount of help in this narrative. Like, he's obviously not living with his family anymore. He's like kind of off the grid, and he goes to this church and is trying to be like the choir director or something. And the guy's like, you know, you can make a lot more money. Oh, also, he's like abandoned his band and refuses to go back with them. And then the guy says, you can make a lot more money, like, work in the clubs. And he says, like, yeah, but there are cops there. Like, this is a man whose life has been ruined because he can't be around a cop anymore. Like, that's a story. And you should focus on that as the emotional fallout and what is happening for the rest of this man's life. Like, it's not like the end of Jaws where you imagine that Brody will never go on the water again and he already didn't like the water that much. Like, this should be... That's the damage, you know? Some of these people, when they're at the trial, you can still see their scars. But, like, the more important scar is that this man has lost his life, even as he lives.
Yeah.
And I think that failing to really recognize that and even, like, pluck that out a little more... Like, don't even have the trial if that's the case. Just stick with Larry and, like, watch this poor guy crumble apart and realize that, like, that's a fucking surrogate for the entire community because of the way the police act with him.
Yeah, him, like, not eating is pretty moving. Like, yeah. That very short sequence where, yeah, he's like, in like, for a second, I'm like, did he move to Antarctica or something? Like, there's something so odd about how that whole thing is framed.
Yeah. Well, time moves very weirdly in this movie after the Algiers thing. Because when they're in the Algiers annex, it's pretty much, like I said, real time. Yeah. Also, something that was left out of the movie is that apparently the Algiers had been well known for drugs and prostitution. It was kind of like known for that, but that oddly enough, the riots made it become more respectable because working people were afraid to walk to their homes. And so they actually went there and it was nice for like those days because it became like a sanctuary.
Oh, hey, that'd be cool to put in the movie.
Oh, wouldn't it? Like, you know, cause it's funny because like when these cops come up and they're like, what are you, their pimp? And I'm like, okay, I get it. You're sure. Racist. But like, that's apparently like a context that they had.
Sure.
But like what these people who were policing this community didn't understand is that this place had changed because they're not part of that community. Like suddenly this den of prostitution and drugs had turned into an oasis, if you'll pardon the term, considering that there are palm trees on the side. I don't know. There's
one
a lot
more
of missed
perspective.
Opportunities in this movie.
One more perspective I'm realizing that is unacknowledged too is that right at the beginning when they first break up the speakeasy, it's actually led by a black detective.
Yeah.
Which is like very unusual in the fact that most of the other detectives are white. And so it's odd that so much of the other movie is based on this clash of race and how that plays into authority and things like that. And that is at the beginning of the movie and totally uncommented upon.
It is very weird. I mean, like, and it's weird, especially because this guy, like, has an informant in there. And the entire reason they're breaking up this party is because apparently he's, like, most of the people in there got warrants. So you're going to get, like, a sweet amount of arrests off of this.
Hmm.
Anyway, so I guess that's our feelings.
Sorry. Sorry, Catherine.
It's so weird. It's weird because, like, her direction of the movie is fine, but her direction of the story, like aesthetically, she's on point, but everything else really falls on its face in like a very bad way.
Yeah.
And I think that having Mark Boll as a writer did not help her in the least.
Like, yeah, I'd like to see her try something with a new writer.
Yeah, I wonder if she had found an African-American writer, if she would have been able to operate a little differently.
Like a John Ridley.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen a lot of, I don't see a lot of like personality in her movies, you know? Like even The Hurt Locker isn't exactly like a nuanced psychological depiction. Like its entire statement is war is a drug. Here is a guy who is addicted to that drug.
Sure.
And it does that by putting him in front of bombs and then making him bored shopping and then putting him back in front of bombs. Like, great movie, don't get me wrong. Love the hell out of it. But it's you can get away with that kind of bombastic, dynamic, like, black and white attitude in a war movie. But, like, this is not the time for that.
She's seeded some of her most distinctive qualities in these latest projects, for sure.
All right. So we are brought to you by Movie, the online streaming cinema. Again, for your free 30-day trial of Movie, go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get a 30-day trial on us so that you can check out the newest things coming to Movie this month. Yeah, so there's another one called The Event. It is a documentary about the collapse of the Soviet Union. So yeah, that's an interesting thing considering that Russia's back in the news. You know, time is a flat circle, I guess. I mean, like, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Like, there's 100 different things to talk about, but, like, I really feel like for, like, a good 20 years, maybe, we had, like, this illusion that things were getting better. And then this fucking weekend, we had fucking Nazis walking through our streets.
Yep.
And no one picked up a gun and killed them. Like, you would think that just, like, video games would have trained us for that. But instead, everyone is out there like, oh, you know, they're not really ideologically Nazis. They're white nationalists. Like, okay, when you pick up a fucking swastika and walk around screaming Hitler's slogans, I don't find the necessity to be nuanced with you.
You and your fucking tiki torches.
That's the other thing. Like, you couldn't even, like, figure out a way to, like, make some better-looking torches. Like, you...
appropriate Polynesian tiki torches, too.
It's so dumb. Like, you know, it's like... And they're all wearing the same fucking golf shirt. And it's just, like, I think about everyone...
They came from the frat formal.
Oh my god. I started work recently and it's business casual. And so I just was looking at it and I'm like, my god, that's what it looks like when I walk through my halls. Except I work at a place that is like 75% people from India. So obviously more colorful. Anyway, so the world's going to shit and Detroit does nothing to help us understand why or how. That's yet another problem. Anyway, MUBI for 30 days free. MUBI.com/filmstage. Give to our Patreon. We could talk about classic movies and go to our Patreon page to see the different tiers of what we will talk about as we get more money. For as little $1 an episode, you get access to our Slack channel, entry into all of our raffles, and all that good stuff. Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We appreciate all of your support. And that's it. We're done. Follow us on Twitter, @filmstageshow. Gentlemen, let's tell the fine people where we can be found at home between now and the next time we speak about... I don't know what we're talking about next time.
Anyway. Nocturama or Good Time, maybe?
Nocturama? Didn't Jordan say that we were pushing that back because something
Maybe we are.
Who fucking knows? Bill Graham, why don't you tell us where we can be found?
Oh, Logan Lucky. Isn't Logan Lucky next week?
I don't know. It is.
Yes. It's coming out.
Okay. Fuck yes. Bill Graham, tell us where you can be found between now and the next time.
You can find me staring agape at the IMDb page for 9/11, the movie starring Charlie Sheen, Whoopi Goldberg, Gina Gershon, and Luis Guzman. That's apparently coming out on September 8th. I have not seen a trailer. I did not know this film existed. It's now I know it, and now I'm like, dude, I'm like, what? Really?
It is up there, wow. It is up there with Book of Henry for year's best trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to check that shit out. All right.
You can find me on Twitter @CableBFG, just staring agape at that. You can also find me on the Slack channel, just trying to shoot the shit with our Patreon members.
Yeah. Woo! All right. Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter @Snydell. What else? Oh, you know what? I've already said what I'm doing in our other podcast for Racerhead. But
say it again.
If you'd like, damn it. All right, fine. I have two reviews coming at the film stage this week. One is for a movie called 6 Days. One is for something called In the Corner, This Corner of the World. And you can read my cohesive thoughts about Detroit on the film stage as well.
All right, and you can find me writing at filmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net. Follow me on Letterboxd and Twitter @BrianJRowan. And I guess that's all. And now we're gonna go out on the sounds of Motown. This is another hit from 1967. It is Diana Ross and the Supremes. Happiness you took from me and left me alone with torn memories through the mirror of my mind, through these tears that I'm crying.